Father, I'm really compelled to do a good job because I want my son Levi to be inspired and challenged. But you've got a whole group of people here, Lord, that I know you want to speak to this morning through this passage. And I'm grateful for the way you've used it to inspire and really, I think, drag out some things out of my own life that I need to deal with from studying this last week and a half. And so, Father, I'm thankful that we have the opportunity to get together and read your word and think about how your intention is to help us become all that you made for us to be and to make life the kind of challenging and joyful experience that you created us to experience. And Father, I would ask that this morning that your Holy Spirit would help calm our hearts and give us the ability to be able to hear from you as we work through this passage. And wherever you need to shape or redirect or challenge us, I'd ask that you'd open us to that. And Father, wherever we can see that you're alive and at work and we can celebrate, I pray that we'd recognize that and give you good thanks for the good things that we get to experience in life each day and each week. So in all these things, Father, have your way in our lives. And we thank you for the privilege of being able to get together. And we thank you especially because of your son, Jesus, and what he's done for us. And it's in his name that we always give you thanks. Amen. All right, good morning, guys. If you have your bulletins inside of it, there are some fill-in-the-blank and some notes. And on the very front page at the bottom, I've got five blanks that I want you to fill in. I'm going to put up on the screen. I'm going to give you a little quiz. I'm going to show you five people, and I want to see how many of the people you can guess who they are just by looking at them. And we'll spend a couple minutes afterwards talking about why they're influential, the marks that they've made in the world, and what that has to do with the passage in Genesis that we're going to be looking at. Okay, so I'm going to show you five people. I imagine every single person in here is going to get 4 out of 5. This is really easy. But you're going to have trouble with the fifth one, I promise you. So let's see how well you do. Okay, first person, who is this? And I want you to think, not only if you know who the person's name is, but I want you to think about how they've been influential in the world, making the world the place that it is that we experience today. So you've got your blanks there. And if I had the Jeopardy clock, I'd play it. Ding, 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 ding. Okay, you guys ready? First person is, who is that guy? Yeah, Steve Jobs, right? He's the original creator of Apple, went away from the company, got fired, actually came back, and of course, you know, highly influential in terms of technology, especially mobile technology. And one of the things is, even if you don't have an Apple product, Apple has been so influential in terms of everybody who makes platforms that we use to interface in terms of our day-to-day use of the internet and our workspaces. Apple's been tremendously influential. So he is certainly influential in terms of shaping the world where we live today. And you'll find that this is true from all these people that we're going to look at. Okay, second person. All right, everybody know who is this guy? Yeah, he's Osama bin Laden. Of course, not everybody has a positive impact on the world. We all take our gifts, our talents, our ideas about the world, and our influence, and we use those things to shape the world around us. And it can have a profound effect on people. So Steve Jobs, you know, how you spend your money and how you interact and use technology, amazing impact, right? Everybody in here. And of course, even if Osama bin Laden, you might not think that he's directly impacted you, think of the impact he's had on our understanding of the world, religion, and in terms of just even how our country spends its tax dollars and promotes what we do with our foreign policy. Enormously influential. All right, third person. All right, this is who? Yeah, this is Mahatma Gandhi. You know what I found out this week? You know the rice? I didn't realize that it's not named after Mahatma. Do you guys know that? That's as funny as I'm going to get today. So if you can't laugh at that, you're going to have trouble laughing at anything today. Another religious figure, highly influential in the world, both Eastern world and the Western world today in terms of how we think about the world and spirituality. All right, another person. Hey, don't give it away. Give people a chance. This is a serious quiz. People aren't getting out of here without getting 4 out of 5. Yeah, this is Oprah Winfrey, right? Again, highly influential. Think about this. Oprah, for the whatever the good, the bad, the whatever impact she's had on the world, whether you like it or not, think about how many people have picked up reading. I just read an article recently about how Amazon went through a boom, and they figured out that in large part, people's reading habits were influenced by Oprah's book club. And people were reading, not particularly the books that she was putting out there, but not just those books. It sprang up more book clubs than we've ever had in the history of the United States. And Amazon went nuts selling books to book clubs around the country. She's had all sorts of impacts on the world that we live in, the way we see things and see other people today. All right, and how we spend our money also, right? Okay, last person on here. This one's a little more challenging. Who is that guy? How many of you have seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? Shows you the depth of my cultural insight about the world, right? Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, they travel back in time for a history report, and they pick up all sorts of influential people around the world. And one of the people they go and they get is Socrates, is how they call him, which is who? It's actually Socrates. Here's the thing. So you may not think that Socrates has a big influence on you, but you know, if you live in the Western world today, the way you think about right and wrong, the way you sort of navigate and make sense of the world, the map that you use, Greek philosophers are incredibly influential on every single one of us, even our understanding of logic. It all comes from the Greco-Roman world, and of course, he's one of the major figures that impacts that. I put all these people up here just to show you a wide variety of people from a wide variety of backgrounds that have lived all over the world that are all highly influential in shaping the way we not only see the world today, but the way we interact with the world. Today we're going to be looking at this passage in Genesis chapter 4, and this chapter has been called the beginning of culture, or the culture forming chapter in the Bible, because it's really the first picture where we start to see culture sort of take on a complexity, going from just the simple Adam and Eve and just sort of their immediate children out into a little bit broader form of the world. And the thing we're going to find out is both for the good and for the ill or evil, we'll see how people and their choices shape the world and the way people see the world and interact with other people, because these people are creating a culture. And so we're going to spend some time interacting with just the second half of Genesis chapter 4. If you were here last week, John took us through the story of Cain and Abel. So the first people that we read about in the Bible in the garden are Adam and Eve, and they have some children, and two of their offspring that we know about are Cain and Abel. And of course, it doesn't go well. Any of you have kids? You know that siblings don't always get along. And sometimes siblings would love to, they talk about killing each other, right? And sometimes you want to kill your kids, if you want to be honest about it, right? And that is actually, it's not just words. It actually comes to fruition where one of the brothers kills the other one. And so you see, you know, it's fascinating to read in the Bible. You see this really fast downhill slide from the way God intended us to live and experience life, to people get away from that really quickly, even to the place where they're taking each other's lives. Doesn't take very long to get there at all, does it? So John walked through that story last week and some of the consequences of it. And I'm going to pick up in verse 17 and just read through the end of the chapter. So if you have your Bibles, you can open up to Genesis chapter 4. We'll start in verse 17. If you don't have that, you can use your smartphone or inside the bulletin, the notes in there. I put it in there also for you. So we'll read through this and spend a couple minutes kind of digesting it together. Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and to Irad the father of Mahushael, and Mahushael was the father of Methushael. Creative names, right? It's like they could have made these a little bit easier to pronounce, I think. Methushael was the father of Lamech. Verse 19. Lamech married two women, one named Adah and the other Zillah. All these names mean something in here. And so even the wives' names, one's means, it's the word for pretty, similar to beautiful, but really it's the word pretty. And the other one is has a nice ring to her. So she probably had a nice voice, whether she was sang or not, I don't know. But that's so he's got a pretty wife and one that sounds good. Oh, if we could all be so lucky. My wife isn't here, and I did not say that during first service. Verse 20, Adah gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all who play the harp and the flute. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain's sister was Naaman. Her name has a whole other rich history attached to it. Verse 23, Lamech said to his wives, and this is the first, it doesn't sound like poetry in English, but in Hebrew, this is a poetry, and this is the first poetic song that we find in the Bible that we know that we can attribute to a specific person. So this is what Lamech said to his two wives, Adah and Zillah, listen to me, wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me. What a nice subject to write poetry about, huh? Moving. Especially if, you know, like, it goes good with wine and cheese and flowers, I'm sure. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. Wow. It's a nice bit of poetry, isn't it? We'll dive into that in just a minute. Verse 25. Back to Adam. Now, this is Adam and Eve. Adam in the garden. Adam, who's now out of the garden. Adam lay with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, saying, God has granted me another child in the place of Abel, since Cain killed him. Seth had a son, and he gave him the name Enosh. Now, this is one of the greatest verses that we've run into in the first four chapters. It says, at that time, men began to call on the name of the Lord. Fascinating, you know, journey that we've gone through, and it starts out with a story in chapter 4 of brothers and their animosity that leads to the murder of one of them, and it ends, though, on this high note, this lifting up note. In spite of all that we've read and seen, it's not like God has forsaken people, and it's not like people have forsaken God. So I want to walk through this, and I want to show you five insights about this, and then ask you just one simple question that I think this story sort of poses to each one of us. Okay, so I think that there are several things that it reveals, and the first one is it tells us about a city, and this is the first time a city is ever mentioned in the Bible. Now, typically, we think of a city as being a place where hundreds or thousands of people gather to live together. But originally in Hebrew, and this is all this really, the basis of this word just means a fortified place, a place where you could go to be safe. And so this is a place that Cain is building. The thing that's interesting about this, that if you read this and you thought about this, that might stick out to you is Cain, when he murders Abel, God comes down and pronounces judgment against him. And Cain is not at all happy about the judgment. And one of the fears that Cain has is after he's killed someone, he's afraid for his own life that someone's going to take vengeance on him. God promises him, he says to Cain, if you read back it earlier in this text, he says, I'm going to mark you and nobody will come after you. And if they do, I will avenge you seven times. So God promises him, I'll take care of you. I'll watch out for you. I'll be your protector. So why is he building a city? Why is he building a place of protection for himself? Is God's promise that he's going to take care of him and watch out for him, that he's got his back, is that not good enough for him? See, I think that one of the stories that we learn in the Bible very early on is that despite whatever God tells us, whatever he promises us, we're still inclined to take matters into our own hands and do exercise our own judgment and do what we think is best at the moment that will give us peace, happiness, joy, protection. And despite whatever God tells us, we're more inclined to trust our own judgment than God's. And it's odd that he would do this, considering that God even warned him about this. And he still took matters into his own hands that got him in so much trouble in the first place. It's like he can't get out of this pathology he has of just doing it all on his own. One of the questions people always ask about the world is how do you make sense of all the evil and all the trouble and all the hostility that people have? What's to blame? And you know, it's interesting. One of the most, philosophically, one of the most suspect places that people tend to blame is when we moved away from being agrarian people that lived off the land to when we became more urbanized and we started to collect together in cities. And a lot of people have blamed the downfall and the evil in the world on cities and people gathering together. In a sense, I think this, on the surface, there is some sense to be made of that. Look, everybody knows when you put people in close quarters together, it can be a challenge to get along, right? Anybody who's got a family knows that. Anybody who grows up and has roommates, we all come to recognize that living in close quarters with other people, it can be a challenge, can't it? Right? And you can exaggerate that by smashing large numbers of people into a small place. In fact, this is one of the things that people in South Lake Tahoe, we tend to pride ourselves on, right, is we're in touch with the earth and the outdoors, and we're not stifled by the city setting. And so we tend to think the problems are the problems of people and created by people in small spaces that never get outside of those. So we look at places like Reno or Sacramento and say, man, I'd never want to live there because of the pressures and that pressure to live together. We look at people in Gardnerville and go, I'd never want to live there. Who wants to live in a dirty, nasty place like that, right? There are five people in here that live in Gardnerville, right? It's a joke. I'm just kidding. But there really is, there's a sense in which we want to say that the problems of the world happen because of urbanization. And there is some truth to that. It's complicated when we live in close proximity with other people. It really does. It exacerbates small problems, makes them more difficult. So there is some truth to this. But, you know, the other reality is that urbanization has also been an enormous blessing to people. When people get together and they're able to use the confluence of ideas and abilities, that's how we've experienced the improvements in terms of technology, our ideas about science, our discoveries about medicine that have benefited so many people didn't happen because people just stayed on the farm, right? In fact, people took the knowledge that they learned from the farm and about life and about the earth and about animals and about health, and we were able to put a confluence of people together to sort of help make sense of the world. The Romantics, and especially in the 18th century, 17th and 18th century, people like Rousseau, they really were hard on this. Rousseau, who sort of believed that God made us, and in our natural state, we're good. But the corrupting influence is civilization. As soon as you start putting people together, they start exercising their own ideas and their own independence, and that's what really produces the evils that we experience in the world. So a lot of people have tried to blame the city on the problems of the world. The reality is for whatever difficulties the cities have contributed to the world, they've also been an enormous blessing. And in fact, God seems to like cities. He tells the people when they go into the land, build places where you can congregate together and celebrate together and live together, encourage and hold each other accountable, right? And live together in a way where you can figure out what it means together to live, honor, and sacrifice your goods and your lives to God. God seems to think it's a good idea. In fact, ultimately, it's funny because if you read the Bible from the beginning to the end, in Revelation, God sort of describes what paradise will be like. Not unlike a city. It's probably not a city the way we typically envision it, but God uses that word, a confluence of many people together, all in one accord, working, sharing, loving, serving, honoring God together. And that word city is used in there. It's the first place where we get a genealogy and we figure out the importance of genealogies. How many of you, when you read through the Bible, you get to a genealogy and the first thing you do is go, I'm just going to skip over this stuff because it doesn't make any sense to us, right? And I totally get that. A lot of times it really does take a lot of work and it's really difficult to figure out what the names mean, why are they in the order they are, what does this have to do with anything? It does take an enormous amount of work, but we find even in genealogies like this, there's really, it's not just a meaningless table of names. There's seven people listed in this first genealogy from Adam down to Lamech. And that order is very important, and I'll tell you about it in just a little bit. But one of the things you find out in the midst of this, remember, is you finally get this place where at the beginning, Adam's a gardener, and it's good. God says, you're a gardener. You got the space. It's yours. Do something with it. Shape it, make it, mold it. And see, that really is God's intent for the world. That each one of us has a unique ability and gifts and talents. And God wants us to bring those things to bear to help create and shape the world around us. And to make the world a place that's not only beneficial for us and beneficial for others, but helps other people enjoy it. And so you find out in this passage, you find out about people becoming experts in nomadic herding, taking care of animals that becomes essential to people's living in their lifetime. You find out about someone who is an expert in making musical instruments and knows how to produce something of value. The arts are something good that's supposed to bring a celebration of life, right? Creativity, to make life enjoyable for other people. You find out that someone has the ability to smelt, which is taking ore out of the earth and forging it and turning it into metals in this chapter also. All of these things come together, and God's expectation is that people would use their unique knowledge about life to bring it to bear to help make and shape the world, to make it an enjoyable place for other people. You know, one of the things you find out about this is so true. Is there anything wrong with the person who knows how, these first people that knew how to make things out of metal? What a cool thing to be able to figure out how to take the raw materials of the earth and forge them into something useful for other people. I mean, think about how much easier that made agrarian people's lifestyle, or the ability to shape and make shelters, right? I mean, amazing, butchering animals, all these things. Those tools were of enormous value, and they also turned into knives and clubs and swords that they used to kill other people. Isn't that true of like anything in earth, in life that we have that's a gift and a talent, right? We can use anything, it seems like, for good or for ill, right? It's not that the talents are the problem. It's how we shape and use them that becomes the problem. It's not the city, it's us. It's the people in the city and how we choose to use the abilities that God gives us to shape the world. So we come to this guy Lamech, and you talk about a guy who is arrogant. Lamech has this boast in there, and it sounds like in this song that he sings to his wives, it sounds like he's been, and it doesn't sound like he's been attacked, but it sounds like someone has wounded him or scratched him, and it sounds like it's a youth. And Lamech says, let me tell you what, someone dares offend me, and they're gonna feel the full force of my wrath. Watch out, because I'm Lamech. I'm the guy. Don't come after me. You will pay. And the way he uses to describe this is, he says, God told Cain, if somebody comes after you, I'll avenge you seven times. And Lamech plays off of that, and he says, if God is going to avenge Cain seven times, I'll take back vengeance 77 times, or it could be 70 times 7. It's really hard to make sense of the Hebrew, what it's saying here. But he's saying, you think that was a big deal, that God was going to protect Cain? Let me tell you what, someone crosses me, they're really going to pay for it. If you look through the list of the names in Lamech's line that go up above him, even starting with the fact that he names a city, he doesn't name it like Jerusalem, like a place of peace. He names the city after his own prodigy, like, this is mine, look what I made for somebody else. There's like a human intent, and there's this slow, steady movement away from God made it, and he made us to enjoy it. And these generations, they quickly move away from that, where they're like, I made it, this is mine, it belongs to me, it belongs to my offspring. And the names, if you work through these, become sort of more boastful about people's independence, down to Lamech. And Lamech is the seventh in line away from the person of Adam. So you might ask yourself, you know, does this problem of arrogance, violence, taking matters into your own hands, is this a new problem? I just read this quote this week, and I thought, man, does this not sum up so much of our experience about the world that we live in today and people's gripes about young people? It says, our youth now love luxuries. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. My son especially ought to listen to this, huh? They have contempt for authorities. They show disrespect for their elders, and they love to chatter instead of exercise. Children are now tyrants, not the servants of their household. They no longer rise when their elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, gobble up their foods, and tyrannize their teachers. Man, oh man, does this not sound like a contemporary list of the problems that we have with youth today? Absolutely. And so in a sense, you could say, look, the problems of the world have always been the problems of the world, especially when you consider this was written by Socrates 400 years before Jesus. Crazy, huh? The problems of the world have always been the problems of the world. The complaints, the arrogance, the violence, the very nature of rebelling against authority. See, it's not a new thing. These problems that we see and experience in the world, they have a long lineage that we can trace very back to the earliest stories of civilization. A couple more things in here. One of the things that's interesting is this is the first place where polygamy is mentioned in the Bible. And people say, well, is polygamy wrong? Does the Bible ever say that polygamy is bad? And it's interesting because, you know, you actually, remember, the Bible's it's full of lists of things that are good and bad, right and wrong. Do you know the Bible never says in black and white letters polygamy is wrong? You know it never says that in there? See, one of the reasons why is because God just sort of assumes that you could look at what happens as a result of when we go outside of his design for life and see what a mess it makes of the world. God doesn't feel inclined to explain why there are all these problems in the world. He assumes that as you look and understand, as people move away, circumvent God's ideas for the world, that you can see the problems that result of that. That's why just as you read through the rest of the book of, even just the book of Genesis, you right away recognize the destructive influence that polygamy has on the family. God doesn't have to say. He's not talking to third graders. He assumes that as you read and you see these problems, you'll figure out for yourself. Polygamy, not God's designs, didn't work out well for the families or the people and cultures that practiced it. How many of you this last week saw the news that in Thailand, they had the first, and it's probably, you know, here's the deal. Look, nothing's new under the sun. Probably not the first time this has ever happened in history, but it's the first time that we know of in recent history where three people of the same sex entered into a covenant of what they called marriage together. And it's these three young men, and they did this in Thailand, and there's a reason why they did it in Thailand. Interesting story that accompanies it. Now here's the thing. Most of us, when we see this, a lot of people, especially Christians, we go, that's crazy. How could people want to do something that is so against God's basic tenets of how we show affection and enter into relationships? Could there be a more, and people might think it's disgusting or immoral or aberrant way of expressing your love and affection for somebody else than to do this, and especially celebrate it with what God said is marriage, which is heterosexual, one man and one woman. That seems to be what God celebrates. See, I think a lot of people, they look at polygamy and they look at a picture like this and they go, man, there's really something wrong with that. So, you know, in my life and my experience, and reading the Bible and thinking about life and doing counseling and looking at my own experience in life, you know what I kind of come to the conclusion of? I don't think that polygamy is the problem. I don't even think that three guys getting married is really the problem. See, how we express ourselves in terms of sexual affection is just a symptom of the problem that we have of rebelling against God. Where we say, you know what? I want to have sex when I want to have sex, who I want to have sex with. I don't want to wait for marriage. I don't want to have just one person. And see, the problem really is not same-sex marriage or same-sex attraction. The problem is in every area of our life, sexuality included, we have our own ways that we want to express our individual freedom in life. And when it comes into conflict with what God says, we just want to go over it, around it, or under it. And this is just one more expression of that. And the thing that really I've come to realize, see, when you look at this and you figure out that this is just an expression of our rebellion against God, the thing that I've really come to recognize is it's so easy in each of our lives to pick on other people or pick on culture and go, there's the problem, there's the problem, here's what you're doing wrong. And the thing that we are last or least inclined to do in life is hold up a mirror and go, where am I in rebellion against God? Where am I actively circumventing, going over, going under, or going around God's clear directives of how he made life to work? And I think that maybe a start to the solution of getting back to a place where we're living in line with how God designed us to live is to spend, it's not that we shouldn't look at the world and use discrimination and judgment, but maybe we ought to spend just a little more time and a little more energy being more introspective and figuring out in our own lives where we're circumventing God's clear ideas of what we should and shouldn't be doing in life. Another thing is, man, is it easy to throw Adam and Eve under the bus? We look at them and go, man, it's all their fault. They didn't get it. Look what they did wrong. It's interesting because in this chapter, there's actually, you can kind of see this maturity of Eve, it seems like. The chapter starts where Eve, when she has her son Cain, the emphasis in the way she says this is she says, look what I've done with God's help. And the emphasis there is clearly in the way the words are put together is Eve is impressed with what she's brought into the world. Look what I've done. And it's interesting because at the end of the chapter, when God gives her another child to replace, it says to replace the one that was taken from her in Seth, she says, look what God's given to me. Really, it's a beautiful picture and a good reminder that no matter where we are or how far away we may have gone, how responsible we may be for messing things up doesn't mean that we can't learn, grow, and mature in our lives and come along to where we start to see and recognize God and his goodness and his grace and where it's at work in our lives. Because that's the beautiful picture of all of this. In a world that's gone so upside down, it closes with this beautiful picture of as far as things have gone off track, you also get these rays of hope and you see God's grace and goodness woven into the story. At the very end here, you get this picture. Remember that last sentence in there that says, at that time, men began to call on the name of God. And that name, the word call there, it means it's similar to the way we think of when you call out for help, God, help me, you know, you're in trouble. So you might think of it as a way of like you pray and you ask God to help you out. But it also means this, and more often times than not, it's used in this way. Come in. Like when you invite someone into your house to be your guest or to be your friend. And that's really the primary way that this idea is used, is someone inviting someone else in. And it's interesting because in the midst of all of this, people are still seeking and recognizing, I can bring God in. There's still this place for him to shape, guide, and mold my life. And that when I do get out of sorts, when I do get off track, I can call out to him. See, we're never too far away. Things are never so upside down that you can't reach out to him. See, this story, I hate to do this because it's nice just to stay right where we are, but it's like begs for us to look ahead because it seems like Jesus draws on this story. And I want to tell you just real quick how this happens. So it seems like there's this contrast to the way Lamech and his anger dominates him and the way God looks at the world. So in the New Testament, Jesus is having this discussion in Matthew chapter 18 with his buddies, and they come to him and they're talking about conflict in that chapter. And Peter asks him this question. He says, Lord, if someone offends me, how many times do I have to forgive him? Seven times? And Jesus comes back on the surface, it just seems totally absurd. You're like, what are you talking about, Jesus? Jesus can't really be saying this, because notice what Jesus says. At the end there, in verse 22, Jesus says to him, how many times? Seven times? And Jesus says, I tell you, not as many as seven, but 70 times seven. Now, I was never good in math in school. I'm still not a mathematician, but that's a big number, isn't it? That's a big number. So I'm just curious, you know, like, can you imagine how difficult it would be to, like, to count every time someone wronged you? And you finally get to that place and you're like, hey, it's been several thousand times now. We're done, right? Can you imagine how difficult that would be? See, it seems like, doesn't it seem like a logical question, though? Like, they're asking, look, in a world where people step on us, use us, and hurt us, at what point can I say no more? I'm done. And the number seven seems like kind of a cool number. It's kind of like, you know, it's 7 days of creation. The number seven is used all over the Bible. It's a great number. It's sort of like God's number. And so Peter's saying, hey, how about we use God's number and we say seven times and after that we're done. Forget it, right? You're cut off. Lamech says, someone crosses me, my wrath will be on them. In the history of the world, when you think about people that have been hurt, used, stepped on, abused, can you think of anybody that's been more mistreated in the world than God? People who have taken advantage of, stepped on, turned their back on, used, denied, made light of? See, Lamech has this picture of vengeance, retribution will rule how I deal with other people when they cross me. And God, who has been crossed and crossed and crossed, misused, manipulated, taken advantage of. John did this fantastic job last week talking about how God's justice is served in the world. But see, rather than, and isn't this true, like you think about this, and I think about this as parents, how hard this is to hold that tension between consequences and judgment and grace and love, right? You know how hard that is to hold those things? And most of the time, I find that in my own life and with most parents I know, it's like we get out of balance and we tend to either be over-judgmental and hard on our kids and lack mercy and grace, or we just extend grace and mercy and there's never any consequences or judgment. And it's funny because God seems to hold both of these things so well. See, he never overlooks the need for justice. But he never pays people back ultimately with just retribution. And I want to show you this in Cain and in us. Cain, when God pronounces judgment on him, Cain says, oh, this is too much for me. He says, I'm going to be a wanderer. I'll be a wanderer and I'll be lost in the wilderness and I'll be marked from death and I'll be cut off from my people. Fascinating. And it's interesting because not all that happens to him. It seems like God is gracious to him. It's interesting because although Cain doesn't suffer those consequences, because he does, he ends up building a place for himself. He's not cut off from his people and he's not marked for death. But it's interesting because there is someone that we read that is cut off from his people, marked for death, and never had a home, wasn't welcomed where he should have been welcomed. See, God poured out on Jesus the punishment that was due to Cain. He was marked for death. He was cut off, not welcomed by his people. And he did lead a lonely existence on life. He says, people have, everybody's got a home, the birds, the foxes, everybody's got a place where they can rest. The Son of Man's got nothing. See, Jesus suffered the punishment that was due Cain so that he could enjoy God's grace. It's not like Cain got off scot-free. You understand that? Somebody did suffer the punishment that was due Cain. It just wasn't him. See, if you and I bared the full weight of judgment against us, we'd not only be cut off from God for eternity, but we'd be crushed by that judgment. And see, it's not that God overlooks it and says, all right, it's too big for you to bear, so I'll let it go. He doesn't just let it go. The cost of our punishment does land somewhere on someone. Just wasn't us. And see, here's the beautiful thing. When you ask for forgiveness, you're drawing on a well, an account that was given for you to draw on. See, forgiveness didn't come free. It was earned for you. And you have an account that you can draw on. See, and here's why the whole Lamech thing makes perfect sense. Which of you, anybody in here just want to say to God, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you, God. Just give me 7 chances to get it right in life. And if I repeat the same mistake more than 7 times, you can be done with me. Anybody want to take that bargain? I don't think so. See, every one of you would say, oh man, thank goodness that God is so gracious that he's got this well that I can draw on. And you do have a well you can draw on because of what Jesus did for you. See, and God says, if you want to enjoy that experience of forgiveness and the reconciliation that comes with it, don't think that you can play life by a different set of rules with other people. When other people come to you and they ask for forgiveness and they want a new chance and a new start, you can't withhold that from them. It doesn't mean that there aren't boundaries. It doesn't mean there aren't consequences, because there are for our sin. But it doesn't mean that you can't live at peace with other people and extend to them the opportunity to be brought in to peace when they deserve it, because you and I get that right and that privilege from God. See, if anybody had the right to be vengeful and angry and deal with people out of wrath and not mercy, it was God. And he doesn't do it. Last thing is, see, the Bible, it gives us like this understanding of the world and history and how things are unfolding and how they're working forward. And it's amazing, because we'll find out that through Seth is you know, the son that came to replace the son that was taken, that God is going to work through that son. And that's where Jesus will come through, is in that line. All sorts of fascinating things about parallel kingdoms in here. Lamech, who is the 7th son from Adam, and man, is he a picture of the reek of death. Adam has another son over here, a different line, through Seth, and you go 7 sons out from him, and he has a son named Enoch through the line of Seth, 7 sons later. So on one family you get Lamech, the smell of death, man, and through the other family, 7 children out from Adam, you get this guy, Enoch, who's not the same person that we talked about earlier. And Enoch's got a whole different testimony. These people over here have this testimony of reaching out to God. And even though the people before him died, it says that Enoch walked with God and he was no more. It's like Enoch was so in one with God and living for his purposes that he avoided death, and he just went from life to being with God. It's this crazy story. So you get these parallel death and life, and they coexist, these family, these people living together. And different people make different choices about how they're going to use their talents, their gifts, their abilities to shape the world. And see, I think that's what this story asks you and I sitting here today. I gave you the picture of Steve Jobs and Gandhi, and none of us will ever have that sort of significant impact, you know, that universal reach that those guys had, right? But don't ever think that your impact on the world is not significant. You, by the choices you make, how you use your money, what you know, your attitude that you bring into relationships with other people, you are making a significant contribution to your world that God has given you. And you're building a city. And you are making a contribution to the city. And we all see the effects of death and life. And God invites you to be a part of his kingdom, restoring to this broken, hurting world life as he intended it to be. And it's up to you as to what kind of contribution you're going to make with your time, your energy, your money, and your attitude. And that's what you'll bring to make your significant contribution to the world where God has placed you. Father, it's so easy to think that other people are more important than us, and what other people do matters, but we're not that big of a deal. But every one of us, really, you put in us our own little sphere of influence. Father, let us take hold of that and recognize the impact, influence, and opportunity we have, great or small, to help shape this world and make it the kind of place that you intended for it to be. Help us to be like the people at the very end of the story that called out and invited you in. Help that to be our testimony in our lives too. And thank you for your grace that you give us to be able to draw on your well of forgiveness. And it's because of Jesus that we have that well. And it's in his name that we always give you great thanks. Amen.